This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, combating state propaganda in Russia and China. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In the family of U.S. federally funded broadcasters, Voice of America is just one of several. Other broadcast entities include Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, also known as RFERL, Radio Free Asia, RFA, Middle East Broadcasting Networks, and the Office of Cuba Broadcasting. All four broadcasters fall under the administrative and management umbrella of USAGM, the United States Agency for Global Media. While the Voice of America and Office of Cuba Broadcasting, better known as Radio and TV Marti, are funded directly by Congress, RFERL and RFA are considered nonprofit organizations, which are funded by USAGM. RFERL provides unbiased news and information to more than 37 million people in 27 languages and in 23 countries, including Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, Russia, and Ukraine, in light of Moscow's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine, which prompted a draconian crackdown by Russian President Vladimir Putin on the few remaining independent media outlets in Russia. The role of RFERL is more important than ever. Radio Free Asia was created in 1996 and provides uncensored and fact-based news to a range of countries in Central and East Asia, focusing on China and North Korea. Well, for more on the role of these legendary broadcasters in breaking through the propaganda and disinformation emanating from Russia and China, we turn to the leaders of each. Mr. Jamie Fly is the president and CEO of RFERL. He previously worked at the German Marshall Fund of the United States and served as senior foreign policy advisor to Republican Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. And Bei Fang, she is president and CEO of Radio Free Asia. Prior to joining RFA, Ms. Fang served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, overseeing public affairs for Europe and Eurasia. She also worked as the Beijing Bureau Chief for U.S. News and World Report magazine, covering the early years of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. She was also diplomatic correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. And both guests join me via Microsoft Teams. Jamie Fly joins us from RFERL headquarters in Prague. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
And Bei Fang joins us here from Washington, the RFA headquarters. Bei Fang, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, Jamie Fly, let me begin with you in Prague. RFERL, we understand, was forced to suspend its operations in Russia, and I believe many had to relocate to Prague. Discuss how the invasion of Ukraine, the second invasion, right? Because, of course, we acknowledge 2014, but this recent one in February, and the drastic crackdown and shutdown of all remaining independent media outlets that don't toe the so-called Russia disinformation narrative about the war. Talk about how this has impacted your operations.
Well, it's been incredibly difficult several months for our team of journalists inside Russia. You're right, many of them had to relocate after the war began because of the risk of doing objective reporting from the ground in Russia. There is a new law that makes it illegal to criticize the military, and criticism of the military is considered almost anything telling the truth about what's happening in Ukraine. And if you're found to violate that law, and there are several cases now that have been initiated against journalists, as well as some civil society activists under this law, you can face up to 15 years in prison. So we've had to suspend our physical operations in Moscow. For our few remaining journalists, they've had to change the way they do their journalism and work more with editors and colleagues who are outside of the country. And we have moved several waves of our people to a variety of locations, some to our headquarters here in Prague, but also to a new facility we're setting up in Riga in Latvia, where a number of Russian media outlets that have left Russia are now headquartered. We're still serving the Russian people, and we're finding that despite the censorship and despite the blocking, Russians are very interested in getting access to independent information, and they're turning to technology, to virtual private networks and other tools to circumvent the blocking and to find their way to our content. And so that's been one piece of good news in a period here that's been incredibly difficult for us as a company.
Indeed. Jamie, I'd like to step back very briefly and ask you to tell us the impetus for creating RFERL in the 50s and how that mission and delivery systems have evolved since then.
Sure. We were set up in the wake of the Second World War, a number of years after Voice of America. And I think while in some ways the missions were similar of obviously reporting the truth, of providing the fact to global audiences, our mission was really surrogate journalism, was highlighting those local journalist voices who were being shut out of the media landscape behind the Iron Curtain. Many of them had to flee, just like today, journalists are having to flee. And so we gave them a home on our radio broadcast at the time, done from our headquarters in Munich through both Radio Free Europe, which was broadcasting to the Eastern Bloc countries, and then Radio Liberty, which was initially separate but was broadcasting to the Soviet Union. And our model really has remained the same. We focus primarily on local and national topics. We do some global news. We occasionally partner with VOA services that operate in the same country and pick up their VOA's coverage of American politics. When I travel and I meet our audiences across our covered region, they come to us for local news. They don't really come to us to find out what's going on in Washington. They know that if there's a VOA service, they can get that from VOA. They can get it from other sources. And that remains our approach today. The transmission platforms have obviously changed significantly. We still do some radio in parts of the world where it's a powerful tool of reaching people. But more and more, our audiences are coming to us online. And that, the digital platforms, is really where we're investing our resources right now and trying to make sure that we stay one step ahead of the authoritarians who are also investing significantly in the digital space and trying to spread disinformation, conspiracy theories. And so digital is really our future, I think, as a multimedia news organization. And that's where we'll be engaging most of our audiences in the years to come.
Thanks for that terrific background. Bei Fang, let me turn to you now. I'm going to ask you the same questions, but in the inverse. Talk about what precipitated the creation of Radio Free Asia in 1996, the languages you broadcast in, and so forth.
Yeah, thank you, Carol. So the impetus behind the creation of Radio Free Asia was the Tiananmen massacre, which happened in June of 1989. So the idea was that suddenly China's censorship of its media came into sharp view. The fact that the massacre happened and that it was censoring all news of it to its citizens within its borders. So, of course, from that time to now, it took a number of years to create RFA, and we finally did our first broadcast in September of 1996 via shortwave into China in Mandarin. And of course, in the 25 years since, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year, China's media tactics have changed so much, as well as its influence around the world. So for us, even though, just like Jamie and Radio Free Europe, RFA is a surrogate broadcaster that focuses on broadcasting unbiased truth to the countries in Asia that don't have free press, we are also increasing our digital presence and also looking at Mandarin speakers around the world and basically pushing back on Chinese disinformation wherever it occurs. So we broadcast in Mandarin, Cantonese, Tibetan, and we have the only Uyghur service in the world broadcasting into China. And then we have Korean, which broadcasts into North Korea. And then we have Burmese, Laotian, Khmer into Cambodia and Vietnamese.
Absolutely fascinating. And now, how would you say, Bei Fang, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which Beijing tacitly supports, at least it has not criticized it, how has that affected your coverage, given that China is pretty much towing the Russian disinformation narrative that this is some kind of, you know, special military operation, that Ukraine is full of Nazis, which of course is an absolute ludicrous statement?
Yeah, well, we've of course been covering China's disinformation relating to the war in Ukraine and the amount of Russian propaganda that it's helping to spread. It also brings into sharp focus the reach of disinformation and the importance of broadcasters such as ours to provide the actual truth into these countries. So we often find that in crises like this, our role becomes even more important. So for example, for us, it was the coup in Myanmar that happened a year ago that really found audiences reaching for the truth. So, you know, within Myanmar, we found that our social media numbers were exploding because, you know, people were really interested, you know, they wanted to know what was happening around them and they needed to reach outside the country for the information.
Exactly. It's really fascinating that you're the only broadcaster that broadcasts in Uyghur language. That's extremely important. Back to you, Jamie Fly, to talk about the obstacles that Vladimir Putin's regime has placed in your way and how you are adapting to circumvent them. You said that there's a great emphasis now on virtual private networks, the VPNs, you're using digital, but those platforms are also susceptible to jamming, as we used to say, you know, with radio. But what are the obstacles you're encountering? And in terms of your penetration in Russia, how would you gauge that, given so much disinformation and the fact that Russians have been so brainwashed, you know, over the past decades?
Yeah, I think the challenge in Russia in particular is that well before the last several months and February invasion of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin was beginning the process of consolidating control over the information space in Russia. He started years ago to strategically take actions in the Russian media landscape, to take over certain domestic media outlets, to block independent media from certain avenues of reaching the Russian people. And we were one of his early targets because we had been invited in by his predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, to set up our Moscow office more than 31 years ago. But soon after taking power, he made it incredibly difficult for us to maintain the radio licenses that we had been able to get in the early post-Soviet years. We eventually lost all of them. He blocked us once we have video content in our 24/7 Russian network current time in cooperation with VOA. From airing that on the TV airwaves inside Russia, he made it illegal for us, for local affiliates, to pick up our content. And so we were really relegated to the digital space. So that was both good and bad, I'd say, at the time. It made us really specialize in our digital audience, figure out how Russians wanted to consume news and information online. And it gave us a bit of a leg up when we got to this point after the beginning of the war, where they actually started blocking websites, banning certain social media platforms. We kind of saw this coming. We were able to prepare for it over the last several years. We were able to begin to educate our audience about how to use some of these digital tools like VPNs or mirror websites where the URL changes on a daily basis. And that's how we think we've been able to keep our audience engagement up despite the crackdown. We did take a hit. We are reaching fewer people today than we would have been reaching if our websites were not blocked, for instance. But we are pleased that because of the extreme interest inside Russia in learning more about what is truly happening in Ukraine, about the economic fallout back in Russia, interest in the content is extreme. And so our numbers since the beginning of the war are up. And even with the blocking, our audiences right now inside Russia are still higher than they were before February 24th in the beginning of the invasion. So we're reaching more Russians today than we were 6 months ago inside Russia. And the question is, will we be able to retain that audience over time? And so we're doing everything possible, both technologically, but then also when it comes to developing our content, to make sure that we're still producing relevant reporting that will continue to draw Russian audiences in and will incentivize them to go through the extra steps that are now required to reach that content.
Very briefly, Jamie, do you have reporters in Russia at all?
We do. We have reporting that's available on our website, rferl.org, including that's translated into English. We do occasional video interviews, men and women on the street in cities across Russia, asking them about the war, asking them about the economic fallout. We have to do that reporting very carefully to protect our people, but we have been able, since the start of the war and the suspension of our bureau in Moscow, to still do some limited reporting from the ground.
Indeed. We're going to take a short break, and then I'll turn to Bei Fang. You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Jamie Fly, President and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Bei Fang, President and CEO of Radio Free Asia. We are discussing the role of both entities in combating the flood of disinformation emanating from Russia and China. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to all loyal listeners across Russia, Ukraine, Central Europe, and of course, Asia. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So let me turn to you, Bei Fang, to ask you about the ability to report, given China is also known for sophisticated surveillance. How is RFA circumventing their censorship of your work?
That's right. So our reporters, so a lot of them are based in DC, actually, and China actually has a way of reaching even those reporters who are based here by targeting their families. So we still have a number of our Uyghur service reporters who are in detention, have been there for years. And it's a really insidious way for the Chinese to try to stop our reporters from doing their jobs. And it's amazing the courage that they exhibit, because they continue to do their work because they realize that if they don't, that the world won't know about the plight of the Uyghurs. So we were the first ones to sort of open the door to the truth of what was happening in far western China and Xinjiang province to the Uyghur people. Our audiences also have to circumvent censorship using VPNs, like Jamie mentioned. There are a number of sort of sophisticated technologies that our sister organization, the Open Technology Fund, disseminates, and our listeners are pretty sophisticated about finding new ways to circumvent the Great Firewall and to reach us.
I'm glad you brought up the Open Technology Fund, Beifang, because it's a very important entity. I didn't mention it because it doesn't broadcast. But Jamie Fly, how important is the Open Technology Fund's operations to you and helping to circumvent these censorship efforts by Russia? Talk about their role.
Yeah, the Open Technology Fund, or OTF's work, has been essential for us for many years in a variety of our markets in places like Iran or parts of Central Asia, some Central Asian countries where our websites are blocked by governments. But we've been working closely with them over the last several months related to the blocking in Russia. They can make VPNs freely available to some of our audiences. They run our network of mirror sites that I was referring to that are these changing URLs that people can get one step ahead of the censor and still access the content. And so they provide essential support and also help us think through how do we educate our audiences about the tools that are at their disposal, because obviously that's the biggest challenge, especially in a case like we've had in Russia over the last 2 to 3 months, where previously websites were not blocked and people maybe did not use VPNs at the same level that they do in other countries. And so a lot of it is the education of the audience and convincing them that this is a safe tool to use, that it's easy to use, and highlighting for them where they can go to access that technology that they now need to get independent news and information.
Turning back to you, Beifang, this is a larger question which would hark to your background as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, overseeing public affairs. And that is the fact that, notwithstanding the extraordinary efforts of both RFA and RFERL, and I might add Voice of America, in trying to combat the propaganda, to get the truth out, the facts, one could probably argue that compared to the financial involvement and the efforts of both Russia and China, what we're doing may be sort of a drop in the bucket, which does not in any way undermine the importance of it. But if you could advise, you know, the Biden administration or the U.S. government writ large, the Congress, what else do you think we need to do as a government, the entities, in terms of really combating more forcefully the disinformation narratives that we're seeing emanating from Beijing and Moscow, because they are all over the place. It's not just infecting their own populations, but they are broadcasting in even in English to Latin America, to Africa, and promulgating these false narratives. I know you're getting more funding, I believe, if I'm not... Press reports.
That's right. Yeah, China funds its media influence campaign at the tune of $1.3 billion a year. And that's just China, obviously, not even Russia. And there's only so much we can do with the funding that we get. But yeah, Congress did increase our funding this year, which is wonderful because it means that we can expand our strategy for countering Chinese disinformation. And one of the things that we've been looking at is we created a global Mandarin service. So it's basically a digital service to look at, to basically target the post-Tiananmen generation of young Chinese all over the world. There was actually a Purdue University study a few years ago looking at foreign students in the U.S., and the Chinese students were one of the only groups that actually became more anti-American the longer they stayed in the U.S. which is totally counterintuitive, but it's because they actually still consume all of their news through Chinese social media. So what we wanted to create, and we worked with VOA on this, each pursuing our own avenues, but what we did was create this channel that also is a platform for people to engage on it, but we use multimedia. We have basically created this, you know, very user-friendly website that is also on all different social media channels, which pushes back on Chinese disinformation about areas that these young Chinese are interested in learning about. So the economy, about health. So we had an award-winning feature on LGBTQ issues in China. So that's one of the ways we have been trying to expand our ability to counter Chinese disinformation around the world. We've also now, with our expanded funding, we have a plan to create a fact-check lab. So working with smaller fact-check labs around the region, starting with Mandarin, but then expanding to other languages, just pushing back, sort of systematically looking at social media, the things that have gone viral on Mandarin social media that are simply untruths, and giving people a place to go for a really clear-eyed view of, you know, how the Chinese are sowing disinformation around the world.
Well, thank you for that, Bei. And now I'd like to turn to Jamie Fly and ask you, Jamie, to, in a sense, put on your policy hat. There's no question that Moscow invests a lot of money, I'm not sure to the tune of $1.3 billion, but at any rate, you may know, to continue to brainwash its own citizens and those in the former Soviet states, as well as other populations around the world. You know, even in the English language, which I guess could argue for, you know, more English coming from perhaps Voice of America or other broadcasters funded by the United States. But nonetheless, what more would you like to do and see, notwithstanding, again, the additional funding you are receiving and well justified from Congress?
Yeah, I think to pick up on what Bei was describing, I mean, the challenge for us in U.S. international broadcasting is that the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, other authoritarian actors have been willing for years now to devote significant resources, not just retaining stable budgets, but actually expanding their funding for propaganda outlets, their efforts using websites and more covert means to spread conspiracy theories and disinformation. And meanwhile, the United States and our democratic partners, for the most part, have not been devoting the resources. They've been funding entities like USAGM and all of our networks, but not really significantly increasing budgets. And this is a space where money matters. And so I think certainly we're very pleased at RFE with this budget increase that we've received this year for the first time in many years, but it's by no means enough, I think, for any of us. If you just look at what the hostile actors are doing. In the case of Russia, the press reporting we've seen since the start of the war is that Vladimir Putin has actually increased spending by 300 to 400%. That's just since February 24th, because he realizes how essential the information narrative is about the war. And by expending those resources, he has been able to make it more difficult for the Russian people to get access to the truth. And that's not even talking about what's happening in some countries on Russia's periphery or globally in a lot of the markets where VOA operates in Latin America or Africa, which are being bombarded by Russian propaganda about their invasion of Ukraine, justifying their invasion, trying to undermine the Ukrainian efforts to describe what's actually happening to civilians and the egregious Russian war crimes, for instance. So I think this is an area that the United States and other democracies needs to invest more resources in if they want to seriously compete. The final thing I'll just say, where I think our work overlaps with RFA's to a certain extent, is even in our coverage region, which we do not broadcast in or provide news and information in Mandarin, and we do not focus on East Asia, in Central Asia, in the Balkans, we're also seeing Chinese investment in the media space there. And so it's not just the Russia challenge that we at RFERL are facing. We're very concerned about China getting into those markets in a significant way in local languages, spreading their propaganda, undermining independent media outlets in those markets. And so it's an area that we're also, even as we're drawn into the conflict in Ukraine, that we're also keeping an eye on and trying to invest strategically when we do get additional resources.
Well, you both underscored the importance of the information war, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guest, Jamie Fly. He's president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Bei Fang, president and CEO of Radio Free Asia. Thanks to both of you for a great discussion and for enlightening us.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.